Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Marvin Bird, a security engineer, and we are going to learn a little bit about what a security engineer does, but also in our explore our primary topic, which is cryptocurrency, a term you may have heard out there, and it's growing in importance, and it's very exciting and very complicated. Welcome, Marvin.
Thanks.
First, let's talk about a security engineer, your day job. What do you do, or what makes you a security engineer?
Yeah, so I manage a team of developers, and we develop tools to help test products that they're going to get sold into the financial sector, to the DoD. We make sure that they're secure, and so we are kind of a lab that's part of a subdivision of the NSA.
Right, so if a vendor wants to make a product that deals with security and or you know, other important government issues, you make sure that the bona fides are bona fide.
Yeah, that the product is secure.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, and that's so important these days when we communicate and make decisions and spend money, not just with a handshake or even face-to-face, but over phone lines and over great distances and everything else. So that's pretty huge. One of the things we talked about a little bit earlier was, as we start this conversation about cryptocurrency, is explains what some of the jargon is, what some of the words are. So cryptocurrency, crypto to me means like a code or a cipher.
Yeah, so cryptocurrency is really started out as like slang. It comes from the word cryptography, which is algorithms used to, you know, hide information, to encrypt it. And so the basis for the underlying technology, which is blockchain, is all based on cryptographic algorithms.
Mm-hmm. I.e. algorithms, computer algorithms, which can't be hacked or broken very easily.
Right, exactly.
Right, and so the cryptocurrency would be I guess, in plain English, a protected method or means of exchange, protected from bad actors with bad intent.
Exactly, yeah, really advanced math so no one can fake the books.
Right, and so then we're going to dive into the depths of distributed ledger systems and blockchains. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so blockchain is another kind of industry slang term. It's really not more complicated than you have a block of data, and then you have what we call a hash, but to, you know, normal speak, it's a fingerprint. And we take a fingerprint of one block of data, and we include it in the next block of data, and then we just say they're chained together. And that's really all blockchain really is.
Mm-hmm. And the data, though, they don't, this is one of the key elements of it, I know, they don't reside on a central server, but rather a multitude of smaller computers?
Right, exactly. So with Bitcoin, every single person that is a miner is also the person that's responsible for keeping track of the ledger. And so the act of mining is what certifies a transaction on the ledger.
And when people mine, they don't dig precious minerals out of the earth. What do they do?
Right, yeah. So the act of mining is inside the block, they have to find a secret magic number such that the resulting fingerprint has a certain amount of zeros. And then when they find a number that has that many zeros, they say that they found the magic number, and then they tell all the rest of the miners, and then they essentially get rewarded with a little bit of Bitcoin by policy.
Right, like a commission.
Yeah, exactly.
For verifying the transaction. Now, speaking of verifying, a lot of things in daily life can be solved face-to-face or with a handshake or a promise, eye-to-eye, you know, I trust you and you'll deliver what you want. But when it's done remotely or over time, there are certain mechanisms which have come into play to make sure that the transaction happens as expected. For example, a standard currency, a physical currency like paper money or coins, etc. I suppose in the old days it might have been diamonds and or oil and spices, mm-hmm, and slaves and all. But oftentimes it requires a third party to sort of guarantee the success. I guess you might say, I was just thinking, I saw one of those armored trucks on the way to Santa Maria the other day, broken down by the side of the highway, and I wondered what shenanigans they were up to. But hopefully just a flat tire.
Yeah,
but you could think of an armored car company as a third party. They make sure that the cash gets from bank A to bank B,
yeah,
or some such thing. But in this case, or in this instance, I think, it and clarify if I'm wrong, that the intent is to eliminate the third party to make it less costly and less complex. Is that accurate?
Well, if you read the original white paper that was published by Satoshi kind of on the dark web, it's the real intention is has a very much power to the people feel, because he talks about eliminating the problem of central banking, the eliminating the issue of having a trusted third party. So really, the core intention is actually more of a power to the people rather than trying to make something more efficient.
Sort of. So there's a, I don't know, I guess you would say if something's efficient, it works well, you get good value out of it, and it's effective, it meets its purpose. But in this case, it is almost a political motive, which would be to democratize finance.
Yeah, because truthfully, traditional SQL database type ledgers are actually much more efficient than blockchain. And so it's really not about efficiency, but yeah, it's really more politically motivated.
And besides the democratization, I have read, and we talked a little bit about this, that one of the big problems in developing countries is a lack of credit, lack of financing. That's where, I guess, the microloan issues come, helping small entrepreneurs work together with microloans to be successful in business. And to them, a very small amount of money is huge, lets them put food on the table or clothes on their family's back. But in this case... it goes to making credit available to people who want to be a success, where a bigger bank or a bigger entity or governmental agency, they're just not there. But it might be if there was blockchain technology and cryptocurrency going on, let's say in the desert or the jungle or wherever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everyone can kind of, it's free to use their cryptocurrency without worrying about, a central banking system deciding whether or not someone should or should not have, a loan.
Right, right, and they may or may not have the person's best interests at heart. Now, speaking of the security side of it, there's a term called, I believe, from my reading, and I know enough to be dangerous, so everybody's warned. But what's called a secure contract? Uh-huh. That's a part of the mining or what the mining operates under, something like that?
The secure contract, so like in a traditional Bitcoin-type cryptocurrency, you have inside the block, when we say blockchain, is just a series of transactions. And then since Bitcoin, there's been a lot of other cryptocurrencies. The most popular one in this area is Ethereum, where they said, why are we just certifying, the movement of transactions, let's allow people to come up with their own utility tokens and smart contracts and really expand the use case for cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm. Sort of make it more developed or, more evolved,
yeah,
I guess, as an activity.
Mm-hmm, yeah, a lot more flexible. I mean, and that's actually what led to the whole ICO crisis and scams that gave the SEC a headache is they didn't really know how to regulate people essentially arbitrarily including, utility token and then publishing it as an ICO saying, please give me money. And people gave them a ton of money and then they disappeared and then, they ran away with the riches.
I know what an IPO, an initial public offering, what's an ICO?
Initial coin offering. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing.
Huh.
So they just essentially – so because, Ethereum had the ability for people to create arbitrary utility tokens, people started doing that and – pretending to have their own cryptocurrency under, Ethereum and saying, this is an initial coin offering, give me, X amount of money for this initial coin and then with the expectation that it's going to grow. And then they did that. And as soon as everyone gave them money for it, they just disappeared. And then the coin, the utility token ended up tanking.
Wow. And we should emphasize too that the whole cryptocurrency, at least the modern version of it, I guess, started with Bitcoin, but there's a dozen or more other ones.
Yeah, over 1,600 at this point.
Oh, 1,600.
Yeah, it's quite a few.
Some of them worth pennies and some of them worth hundreds of thousands of dollars or more,
I guess.
And I guess, too, we should explain before we go on that the, I don't know, let me talk about my limited understanding of finance. Like, we went off in this country the gold standard back in, I want to say, the 1930s. And the gold standard meant that you literally could take paper to a U.S. Treasury or mint and get gold, whatever the going price was at the day. But nowadays, the dollar's value is more about confidence in our government or our economy or the stability of both of those things. So it's more ethereal, more psychological, and it's not based on hard, commodification of something, but with cryptocurrency – the ICO, isn't it true that they put out an initial amount of shares that you can buy. It's finite, something like that?
Yeah. Usually it's finite. Someone essentially, they create a certain amount of their token, and then they create some unknown amount for themselves, and then they do whatever they need to do to convince the public that it's worth a certain amount, and then they quickly sell off whatever they created for themselves, and then they make a bunch of money, and it tanks the market at the same time.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, our financial advisor helps us, make some investments. And I mentioned this to him, and he just shook his head like I just said a big cuss word or something. Because maybe with a traditional mindset or traditional setup, it's not evolutionary, but revolutionary.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are really, really angry at everything that the SEC is doing to crack down on it. And I, for one, am a total proponent of allowing the flexibility with cryptocurrency to continue. But on the other hand, I think that the SEC really did have an obligation to try to enact some additional laws because, cryptocurrency became mainstream and a lot of people lost a lot of money and they were really giving a lot of pressure because in this day and age, we kind of expect everything to have a basic amount of regulation. And so I think they were doing their best in a lot of ways to try to come up with regulations so that way people could get involved and feel safe.
Yeah. I think a lot about in my golden years here about what it takes to live in any particular society. And it seems to me that smaller and more informal, the less rules you need. For example, if you live on a desert island with 20 other people, maybe family members, everybody knows everybody and you know what their quirks are and whether they work hard or whether they're dependable. But if you took that same family or same group of 20 and scattered them out over the globe, you wouldn't know people face to face. And I think that's when you need regulations. Basically to protect the sheep against the wolves, because there's always going to be wolves out there. And so I guess when we talk about the advent of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology democratizing and becoming, saving and all kinds of wonderful things for people and how they buy and sell things, the anonymity of it, to me at least, is a bit of a concern because we know the example that in the early days, some of the cryptocurrencies, perhaps Bitcoin, were used to buy and sell hard drugs.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the unfortunate truth about that is a lot of people acknowledge the fact that the reason why Bitcoin got big in the first place was its involvement with the Silk Road, where there are movies or documentaries where people were able to order hard drugs and it would come in a normal shipping right to their house.
Silk Road, in the historic sense, was I think a caravan from the Middle East all the way to China and back. But we're talking about a more modern version of that on the internet that was, for a while, I guess, quite lucrative and quite successful in buying and selling of narcotics and other things like that.
Yeah, it's probably the most major spot on the dark web that people will go for illegal activity.
Sort of down to the nitty-gritty, I don't know if you know the answer, but if you have a worldwide network of miners and compatible hard and software, buying and selling things with bitcoins and not only exchanging goods, but making loans and making some profits along the way. Mm-hmm. And it's completely democratized and for the security purposes anonymous. If there's a bad actor or a bad plan, are there what kind of protections or safety mechanisms are there?
Yeah, so this is there's not an easy way for me to kind of answer or explain this, but essentially the only type of attack that's really possible when you have what's called a distributed ledger that Bitcoin operates on, and it also does something called the proof of work, which is the basis for mining. And that's that effort that we have of trying, millions and millions of random numbers to identify the right magic number that, says that we were able to successfully mine the coin. What happens is as long as the majority of nodes, 51% of the nodes, are good actors, then there's no way to essentially fake the books.
Really?
Right.
And can that be explained in plain English, how that works or why? I mean, because a lot of times, the old adage, one apple in a barrel, it's rotten, it tends to rot the rest of them.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah. So what happens is once someone has found the right magic number, that certifies those set of transactions. And then in order for someone else to then fake the books of one of those transactions, they have to find a new magic number. So it requires just as much work.
Ah.
And so what happens is the consensus algorithm is essentially based on whoever has the longest chain. And so So there's all these miners happening at the same time, and they're constantly finding magic numbers, and whoever has the longest chain they assume is correct. And as long as the majority of nodes agree on it, you would have to the amount of work required to fake the books means that you have to fake that transaction and every transaction after it, because the blocks are chained together.
Right.
So you have to, you know, if it takes 500 million or a billion magic numbers to find the next one to certify it, you have to do that for every single block in the chain.
So it could be done, but you know, it might require 100 years and.
Yeah,
you know,
and then all the other good actors are constantly adding to the correct chain. And so, I mean, and then you counteract that with the fact that it's a reward system. So people are actually getting real financial rewards anyway to be a good actor. So there's not even much of a financial incentive.
Who invented this idea? Or is it a person that came up with this and when?
Yeah, so this is my favorite topic about cryptocurrency because I don't remember his full name, Satoshi.
Japanese, right?
Yeah, well, maybe. Oh. No one to this day knows who was the person who published the white paper that started all this. He essentially published this white paper on the dark web and started working with programmers in the light to create Bitcoin. And so...
It's a pseudonym then.
Yeah, and so to this day, no one knows who came up with the white paper that started it all. And it's quite fascinating.
What are some of the things coming up that people need to pay attention to? Maybe the average person in the street, the entrepreneur who wants to use cryptocurrency to make a buck, what would those people be looking for? How would they get better informed?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the cryptocurrencies that have the market share are not necessarily the ones that have the best technology stack. And so until that starts changing, investing in cryptocurrency is really more gambling. And also, I would just avoid any ICOs unless you really have the technical capability to analyze it properly. So I would be very cautious. However, I think that now that the market has flooded and there's 1,600 cryptocurrencies, I think over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to start seeing the, for lack of a better word, the right cryptocurrencies start to emerge out of the pool of cryptocurrencies. And I think it'll, you know, moving forward, it'll slowly shift from being gambling to real investment.
My son, and we were also talking about this earlier, my son that got me interested in this and to invest a little bit in one of the coins, sent me an article. It was long and full of charts and everything else, but it talked about the birth, life, and death of currencies, historically speaking. You know, in the early days, it might have been shells. We talked about that, or tobacco, or jewels, or slaves, or you know, anything you can think of that has value and is transportable. But all of these, or most all of these things, went through a gestational period where at first it was tiny and then it was a little bit more bold, but people kind of scoffed at it. But then it got accepted by a country or a big bank. Mm-hmm. And over time, either died out or proceeded. But there's an evolutionary path that pretty much all modern currencies had to go through. And crypto coins are partway through that process right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the biggest ways in which they're going to continue to become mainstream are, like you said, when you have smaller countries that have instability in the government and their financial institutions. We've already seen it multiple times where there was a very rapid mass adoption of a cryptocurrency because people still needed to transact, and they were looking at the government. The government was not providing the support, and so they just took it upon themselves because they had these new tools available. And I think as that happens going forward, if it really does become the primary way that people exchange, I think it's going to be very hard to reverse that process. You know, having the flexibility and the freedom to exchange your own way, and then afterward having another authority come in and say, now you have to use this, I think that'd be very hard to reverse that process.
So, and we touched on this earlier, you know, establishment, whatever the establishment is, be it here in our country or around the world, they probably don't like change very much, or unless they initiate it and they control it. And this is... This is pretty radical. This is from the streets, if you will. And is there a way you can answer what the attitude of governments or the financial sector, like banks, in general is? Is it one of caution? Is it one of let's stamp it out like a disease? What?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know the right answer to this. I can give my opinion from just looking at the landscape. To me, it really seems like the banking institutions are the ones that are very adamantly against this, because it seems to, it encourages them to have less control. But to be honest, I actually think that the government itself, the U.S. government, is actually not as against this as people might think. Recently went to the TechCrunch up in San Francisco, and I saw the lady from the SEC speak, and they put in a lot of effort into trying to make it easier for people to digest and understand what the rules and regulations are for small businesses and investors like that. And so it's right, you can get access to it, I think, from the SEC front page and kind of various tests. So you can try to determine at home, where it fits under as far as regulations go.
To me, one of the most fascinating things about this, kind of gives me goosebumps, is, and I'm a librarian, and so I believe in all kinds of media, but books, you can't hack a book. If you're reading a book, I might crane my head to see what title it is, or even get close to you and see what the words are on the page. But if you're doing something online, I could be next door or around the planet, and I could hack into what you're doing. We, in my Rotary Club, had a cyber chief of the National Guard, California National Guard, and basically told our Rotary Club, there's no system that's unhackable. And I raised my hand, well, how about books and how about papers, and putting stuff on physical media. But this is electronic, and this is huge, but its hackability, vulnerability is minute.
Yeah, I mean, so in the field of security, he's right. There's nothing that is absolutely unhackable. But you reach a certain point of security where you say it's not something that we're ever going to have to worry about actually occurring. And I think the way that cryptocurrencies have set up a reward system in combination with a proof of work, I think is a very reasonable line to draw. I mean, I've had some really hardcore technical adversaries say, well, what if, two countries lost communications of their internet entirely? And okay, so then you're in a situation where you essentially have a split of cryptocurrencies, and that's a really far, far out
edge case.
Probably
temporary.
Yeah, temporarily. Yeah. But really, as far as transacting go, I think it's incredibly secure. So
Are there any nations or industries that are ahead of the curve that you can think of?
It depends on what you define by ahead of the curve. I mean,
in understanding and utilizing the technology.
Yeah, not nations. I mean, there's nations where it's become, extremely used, but not by the government. Venezuela is a classic example that I think a lot of people are familiar with. There's a lot of movement going on in the real estate industry where people are wanting to, because of how complex it is to trade real estate or parts of real estate, they want to use, cryptocurrency to represent ownership of real estate. And so people can very easily buy and sell portions of real estate.
For the average person out there, final comments. Two questions. How does the average person find out more and become more well-versed in this? And what do you see as the next big trend in cryptocurrency? Those two things, education and the next big trend.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best place for education is whatever cryptocurrency you're interested in is really going to their website and seeing what they're saying about it, because there's not really an authority. Except for the SEC, I would also go to the SEC website and see what they say about it, and I would research what the individual cryptocurrency developers say about their website.
Maybe compare the two.
Yeah. My hope is that the trend is that we start – there's a lot of movement in looking at cryptocurrencies in kind of open government situations, and I would hope that we start considering using cryptocurrencies and blockchain to really solve some major problems and root out some corruption in government.
Wow. That's so exciting. We should do a round two of this. This has been Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library, for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Marvin Bird, security engineer, talking about cryptocurrency and blockchain. Thank you, Marvin.
Thanks, Brian.